Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Corey Johnson, Bloomberg West editor-at-large and moderator for today's program. It's my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Robert Shiller. Robert Shiller is a Yale economist. He's won a slew of economist awards, widely quoted, widely admired, one of Bloomberg's 50 most important people in finance, yada, yada. But there's an important reason we listen to Robert Shiller. He's an amazing ability to see problems coming down the road. And if you listened to Robert Shiller, you could have avoided a lot of those problems. Maybe you could have made a little money in the process. What kind of problems? Well, how about the problematic belief that the market's efficient, that everything bad and good is already priced into the market or the price of any given stock? Shiller pierced that whole idea back in the early 80s before most of us had heard about it or seen what Warren Buffett could do to squeeze value out of the supposedly efficient markets. In the late 80s, he proved through behavioral finance that the market was likely to be much more volatile and emotional than any rational calculation might suggest, in some ways predicting the crash of 1987. Not done in the late 90s, explained why the dot-com bubble had to pop, predicting the March 2000 market crash in his best-selling book, Irrational Exuberance. And for all that, Shiller is probably best known for calling the overinflated housing market. In 2003, he wrote a Brookings paper titled, "Is There a Bubble in the Housing Market?" He was widely mocked for a prediction that housing prices could fall by maybe 50%, but in just about 5 years, they fell 40%, dramatic fall. So what's happened in the housing market, what's happened in the stock market, the idea of the kind of risks that are out there and can be seen with a careful eye, Robert Shiller's certainly proven that. But his new book is a really interesting take on the potential for finance and the potential for what our society can look like at a time when there's so much fight about who should be taxed, about what the 1% is, about who deserves what they have and how capitalism even works. So Robert Shiller, we're glad to have you join us here with the Commonwealth Club of California.
Well, Corey, you gave a number of examples of me predicting disasters of one sort or another. So I'm liking to get out of that mode. I'm not planning to predict any disasters tonight. I think what I want to do is talk from a longer time frame about how we got here and where we're going. I tell my students we have a 100-year horizon. Because young people are going to live 100 years, maybe, or their children will. A lot of changes are coming, and it's hard to write about them and think about them. But the title of my book, Finance and the Good Society, was meant, I don't know how you hear that, but it was meant to have a little tension in it because it seems like an oxymoron. Finance seems to be this evil business that makes the rich richer, and it seems to be opposed to the good society. I've been teaching finance at Yale University for 25 years now. And I also teach to the whole world because my Yale course is on Open Yale and broadcast. You can take my course, by the way. It's online and it's free. I have exams and problem sets if you really want to go the whole way. But I won't grade you. So, I've been concerned over the years that it almost seems like I'm doing a bad thing. So I feel, because people are so angry about finance today, and it seems evil, I feel a little bit like an ROTC instructor during the Vietnam War. Catherine Rampell wrote an article in the New York Times a couple of months ago based on her asking top universities what fraction of your students went into financial services. And the general answer she got was, for just before this crisis, was something like 25%. She was questioning whether that was too high. The record was Princeton, which had 46% going into finance in 2006. Some people that you're frowning, I think. I'm touching a nerve here, I guess, that people are They think, whatever happened to science or engineering or education or the helping professions is something wrong. Well, I'm not going to say what the percent should be, but I want to think about that. And I think that, see, part of the reason, now, I hope I don't anger some of you. I've given talks like this in the past, and it sounds like I'm apologizing. So let me say right up front that there are some really awful people in finance, okay? And so, but there are also, the difference is, there are some really awful people in education, too. But you don't read about them in newspapers, right? Because they don't get rich doing it. They get lazy, for example. And that's not a good newspaper story. But the thing is that there's a fundamental problem with being so angry at finance, and that is that we're going through a worldwide miracle of economic growth in all of the emerging areas of the world, in Asia, in the Middle East, in Latin America, in the former Soviet countries, even in sub-Saharan Africa. And I believe this is because of our financial capitalism. We're emerging into an era of financial capitalism. And financial capitalism is, what is it? It's really about new methods of allocating resources, incentivizing people, and managing risks. And it makes business work. Now, I'm sounding awfully, I don't know, pro-market, but I'm going to come back and say that it only works when you have proper regulation. The system we have is an invention that was developed through experience over hundreds of years, and the countries that have adopted it have done really well. And now it's kind of an open secret that this works. So when Lula became president of Brazil, people thought he was leftist and he was not going to be friendly to business. But he was friendly to business, and now there's a miracle in Brazil. But it's not just Brazil, it's all over. The financial crisis has created a sense of serious problem with this. But I don't think that it's yet tipping the balance so that we would actually stop this progress, not at the current point. But there's a sense that you'll get in some discussions of the recent crisis that it's some malefactors who caused the crisis. Well, there are malefactors. But it seems to me that the question should be, what kind of economic system do we want? You know, we live in a world where there's all kinds of people. And there are some people that scare others. They haven't committed any crimes yet, right? And you kind of want to stay away from them, but they're out there. And unless they commit a crime, they're going to be out there. So we have to design a system that encourages them to be constructive. There are aggressive, selfish, greedy people, okay? They tend sometimes to go into finance because it's a good place if that's your personality. Although I tell my students, if you are sociopathic, don't go into finance because there are rules and regulations and you will be discovered. That's my thing. And so try to go into something that's more more benign, my advice. The problem that created this crisis was a couple of things that we didn't understand, and I think we understand better now. One of them was the systemic vulnerability of the whole system. We didn't have data on the interconnectedness of financial institutions. The Dodd-Frank Act is going to provide more data on it, but we didn't have it, and we didn't understand how vulnerable the system was. We got very leveraged. There was a lot of borrowing, inflating asset prices, and not well enough understood. The other thing is that we had a tremendous bubble in real estate markets, and that bubble was not appreciated. That there was a You know, the one thing about people, I'm going to talk about human psychology. One of the most striking thing about people is that they can be brilliant in some dimensions and really ignorant in others. If you think about history, you realize that somehow it became conventional wisdom that home prices never fall. And I just find that amazing. I actually talked to people before this boom and tried to understand their thinking. They're very smart people. And, you know, they would be kind of dismissive of my asking. And if I pressured them, they'd say, well, home prices have never fallen. And I'd say, well, wait a minute, what about Japan right now? Or what about the Great Depression? And they would say, well, that's Japan, and that the Great Depression, that was a long time ago. And that's all they had to say. But somehow, we got into this crisis because of those mistakes. So we have to fix them. But what do we do to fix them? That's the question. That's what I think is a challenge for young people today. But the question is, what should a young person who is idealistic do? Should he or she avoid finance? I don't think so, because I think that it's so much the hope of our future, and it involves so much transformation. You don't want to leave it to the sociopaths. You don't want to. There's a moral responsibility to get involved with things that matter. We understand a lot more fundamental about finance through our development of behavioral finance. That's the science of finance with study of psychology and sociology and other social sciences embedded. Also, we have something called neuroeconomics now that's just developing. So many different intellectual traditions are getting involved. The medical school is getting involved in economics now because they're learning so much about the brain. And one thing we learn is that people have a lot of circuits in their brain that bring out certain behaviors under certain circumstances. You have an impulse to be selfish, and if there's a sale and the items are being grabbed up quickly, you have an impulse to run in there and grab before the next guy. But at the same time, you have an altruistic spirit. And that's well established now. It's part of your repertory. And the thing that's nice about modern society is that we've found ways to mitigate the bad tendencies and put them in good stead. But it doesn't. We can never get people to be perfect. They'll always be egotistic and selfish and all those things at some times, and that's just the life. So my history of financial institutions is a history of learning about these things. So, for example, in 1811, New York, the state of New York, created a new securities law, which did two things. A corporate law. It allowed anybody to set up a corporation with minimal restrictions. You used to have to go to the legislature and get special permission. And secondly, they created limited liability for investors. And what that meant is if you invested in a company and the company was later accused of wrongdoing, the lawsuit could never go after your assets because you invested in the company. Before that, people were afraid to invest in companies they didn't really know. So it made everything like a family business. You had to have people you trust. The law changed everything, and it was copied over all the world. Now, according to David Moss, who studied these carefully, what I think it did is it created a sense of pleasure in investing. People used to invest in lotteries. They loved to gamble. That's another human trait. They love the excitement of finding out whether your number came up. By creating limited liability, it became fun, the same way a lottery is fun. I mean, people have to enjoy life, right? There has to be something that makes you get out of bed in the morning and gives you some excitement. And so we design things that give you that feeling. That securities law has been the source of a lot of our innovation because now investors, it looks like they're playing a game. It looks a little selfish, but it drives our economy. Other people, Karl Marx looked at it and said it's gambling, and he thought we should shut it down. Worse than that. Worse than that. After years of experimenting with that, people think, well, maybe we have to let people indulge in these feelings. So, let me move. I have another, maybe I'll go for another 10, 15 minutes. I wanted to talk about the future and about some of the ideas that I talk about. I'm going to start from tomorrow and then move a little bit more and more into the wild future. What happens tomorrow is President Obama has said that he will sign the Jobs Act. That name for the act was a little bit misleading, maybe for some political reasons. It's not about jobs. It's called Jumpstart Our Business Startups. That spells jobs. And what it is, it's controversial. I like it, though. Notably, as an experiment, it may or may not work well. But let me tell you what is the most interesting part of the Jobs Act. The Jobs Act was created in response to requests from internet website providers who wanted to create a crowdfunding website for entrepreneurs. So you, if you're trying to start a business, you can put it up on their website and say, I'm looking for money. And then thousands of investors or millions all over the world can send money and you can start a business. Now, this is a wild-sounding idea, isn't it? But it's endorsed by a lot of internet people. I think it's just about as wild as Wikipedia sounded at the beginning. So if I came to you 10 years, when did Wikipedia, I don't know, say before Wikipedia started and said, I'm going to open an online encyclopedia and I'm going to let anybody in the world add to it. My first reaction would have been, that's a dumb idea, right? It's not going to be a good encyclopedia. But it's just, we learned something about how people can work together through Wikipedia. So I think this is a good experiment. Now, what Congress has done is they're worried that it's going to be, there's a lot of cheats out there, unfortunately, and someone is going to steal money from someone else this way. So one thing they've done in the legislation is that for people, you have to document your income to the website, and for people with incomes up to $40,000, you can't invest more than 2% of your income, which is, what, $800. So it's small for each individual. And that protects people, right? It can't go that bad. And I think the maximum is $10,000 that you can put in if you have a higher income. So it's designed to protect people. But, you know, even if people can only invest $800, if you get enough of them, you've got real capital. And the thing that's exciting to me about it, it reminds me of an insight that Friedrich Hayek had in the 1940s in his book, A Road to Serfdom. And that is that when you really think about it, information about the economy is very widely dispersed across people. He said that there's a lamentable fact in 1944 that people think that scientists know everything or scholars know everything. But in fact, so many of the important things that you need to know about business are dispersed. They're local things, like where would be a good place to open another coffee house or what kind of coffee house would sell in our district. And that kind of dispersed thing could benefit from crowdfunding the way Wikipedia did. I don't know if it's going to work, but I'll start with... let me move on, because I have so many ideas here and I can't get through them all. That's tomorrow. Obama said he'll sign it tomorrow. But you won't see, by the way, these websites for a while because they have to go through regulatory hoops. But maybe in a year, you'll be starting a business, through some of you, in crowdfunding. Next thing, the Benefit Corporation. Now, this is actually 2 years old. The first Benefit Corporation was created in Maryland in 2010. And what it is, and now 8 states have them, but it's spreading, and I assume most states will have them eventually. What is a benefit corporation? It is a corporation which, in its original charter, defines some public benefit. It's a for-profit corporation, but it has a dual mandate: make profits and do something for society or for the environment, some cause, good cause. And the company can write into its charter its own definition of what social benefit it wants to pursue. So that means it can attract investors who focus on that particular thing. I noticed that there's a fertilizer company, makes fertilizer, and its charter says that it wants to restore a healthy nitrogen-potassium-sodium balance in the Earth's soil. All right. Now, that's not a cause that most of you here are sympathetic to, but I think that's where we have a democratized finance, where people who are interested in that cause can invest in something like that. We're going to have a lot of diversity in benefit corporations, and they'll appeal to people. Now, the question is, will it succeed as a for-profit? Now, the American idea has been companies have to be exclusively for-profit. If you blur that, they're going to play tricks. There's all kinds of bad things will happen. Well, the benefit corporation is another experiment. Maybe it won't work. Maybe we have to tinker with it. But my guess is that it will turn out to be more profitable than a strictly for-profit corporation. Now, that may sound paradoxical. How could that be? If you tell the board of directors, just make profits, don't do anything else, or if you tell the board, we want you to make profits, but we want you to be contributing to the community as well. I think the latter will make more profits in the long run because they will have the loyalty of the community, the support of the community. They will have the workers who feel better about the company because they feel that this isn't just about making money. So that's my prediction, that this will be another success. There hasn't been a benefit corporation in any country yet. This is, I'm giving you two examples of American innovation that's just happening. Now I want to move more into the future. I'm thinking about making philanthropy a more rewarding experience. I tell my students think they'll be billionaires, and maybe some of them will. You never know in the next 50 years, right? We're growing so fast. But I think that they should give it away. It doesn't make any sense to accumulate money. Andrew Carnegie said that in his Gospel of Wealth in 1879. I think it's still true. There's a moral imperative to give away your... Well, it's kind of a game. Life is a game in some sense. I don't mean to make that cynical a statement, but you're trying to do something that stimulates you and wakes you up, and making a lot of money is fine if you're going to give it all away, right, or most of it away. But the problem is that it doesn't seem very satisfying or enjoyable. There's something missing about philanthropy. When someone calls you up at dinner time and they try to get you to give money, and you wouldn't want to give away your life's work just like that, and then it's gone. It doesn't seem exciting. So, incidentally, I think probably all of you here have logged on to Wikipedia at some point, right? And have you noticed that there are these banners at the top saying, please donate? Jimmy Wales is asking you, please donate $100 to Wikipedia if you... And I won't ask for a show of hands, but I've asked it in other audiences. It's like 10% has done it. Why not? Why didn't you give $100? Well, I think that there's something... Yeah, you maybe you thought you'd do it eventually, but you haven't done it yet. It's not something that you rush out and do. So I thought we have to think of new institutions that are more fun and more rewarding. If you've made $1 billion and then you just give it away, it just seems so anticlimactic, maybe. So my idea, I'm trying to think of how to do this, but it's just an idea and it may not be exactly right. I want to define a new kind of nonprofit. This is not a benefit corporation. This is a nonprofit, which I call a participation nonprofit. And what it is, it has to be created by the government, but the institution has, the structure has to be created by the government. What it is, it's you can make a... I envision this for something like a hospital, a nonprofit hospital or a school or a college. You can make a donation to these, and it's tax deductible, just like a charity. Well, it is a charity. It's a nonprofit. It's for the public good. But there's a difference. Your donation takes the form of your buying shares in the nonprofit. And then the nonprofit pays dividends from its income to your account. And it's yours to allocate with the one proviso, only to charity, only to good. You can't spend it on yourself. Now, I don't know if this is, again, I don't know if I'm connecting with you on this, but it seems more fun to me because we have a natural desire to accumulate. And we want to be appreciated. We're egotistical. Everyone wants to be loved and to be praised. And so how about letting you accumulate money in a special account as a result of your having made a gift? Wouldn't that be more interesting and more exciting? It also, you'd want to put the money into some enterprise that's going to be big and important, like Wikipedia, for example, or something like that. I think they could get a lot more money with a framework like that. And then you could pull it out. You know, what happens to nonprofits today? They set them up 100 years ago, like a hospital. It's not a great hospital, maybe. You know, people aren't that happy, but it does make a profit, and it keeps plowing it back into the hospital. And, you know, smart people know that, you know, it should go elsewhere. Well, this would give you some kind of oversight, I'm thinking. Anyway, let me move on to some other ideas. Continuous workout mortgage. I think that we should have mortgages that are designed with a pre-planned workout. If the economy turns sour and home prices fall or unemployment rises, what is a workout? Today, if you can't pay your mortgage, you go back to the mortgage servicer and you say, give me a workout, and they will say no, and that's the end of it. They may keep you in doubt for a long time. But I want it to be pre-planned and automatic and continuous. And that means that as home prices fall, your payments keep going down. As long as it keeps falling, they keep going down. And you don't have to ask anything. They'll just do it. It'll all be computerized. Now, that sounds a little strange. It's never been done. But why not? We could do that. Now, I think they'd have to charge a higher rate. This is a free market institution. We need the government only to regulate these and make sure they're clean and clarify the legitimacy of them. But I think if we had had continuous workout mortgages, we wouldn't have the problem we're in now. We wouldn't have more than 10 million households underwater. We wouldn't have all this complaints that you bailed out the corporations and now you're not bailing out me, the homeowner. Because we wouldn't have had the, well, you would have been automatically bailed out, not by the government, but by a private institution. And we wouldn't have maybe had to bail out the institutions either. Now, you might be asking, how is this going to work? How can a mortgage originator originate a mortgage that has these big reductions in payments in bad times? Well, therefore, I think we need more financial sophistication to make that happen. And finance is a beautiful theory that tells you how lots of things can happen if you think about it. One thing is they could securitize these mortgages. The originator, this sounds like a bad word, right? People hate securitized mortgages, but it spreads risk. That was always right. And if it's done honestly and well, it will do that so that the mortgage originator puts it in portfolios all over the world and it doesn't hit them so hard. Also, we could develop futures and options markets on real estate prices. Well, I have to say, I have been involved in doing just that. I have the S&P Case-Shiller home price indices that my colleague Carl Case and I originally developed. And we have the Chicago Mercantile Exchange started offering futures prices on 10 U.S. cities, futures markets for home prices, including San Francisco. And they've been going for 5 years now. So you can hedge, or a retailer creating products like continuous workout mortgages can hedge the risk. The CME just opened a few days ago a new options market based on our indices. So the problem is they're not working well yet. There's not many people into it, and we have to figure things out. But I think in the future we'll have, this is the opposite of what Warren Buffett said. I respect the man a lot, but he's not always right. And he said, derivatives are weapons of mass destruction. Well, I think they're dangerous. Just like anything that's powerful is dangerous. But we can regulate them, we can get it right, and it will make for a better world. Maybe that's all he meant. That's like nuclear power. I won't get into that. But so another idea, I have a couple more minutes maybe. Yeah. Another idea is that the government should issue debt indexed. Well, they issue debt, as you know, right? We have a huge national debt, which is a concern now. The U.S. government has never in its history issued equity, which means shares. Why not? Companies do it. They issue both debt and equity and options and warrants and all kinds of things, but on swaps and other things. Let's at least move a little bit beyond the most conservative form of obligation from the government. So the proposal that Mark Kamstra and I have made, he's a professor at York University in Toronto, we propose that the government issue what we call trills. A trill is a 1/1,000,000,000th share of U.S. GDP, okay? We just sell shares in our country. Now, the advantage to doing this is that if we have a recession, the obligation of the government goes down automatically with the GDP. I'm also saying we should leverage them up, too, but I won't try that here. If Greece had issued trills, Greece, especially if they were leveraged, there wouldn't be a Greek crisis, because the declining GDP in Greece would have bailed them out automatically. Why are we doing all these after-the-fact bailouts? The government, you know, Angela Merkel has to deal with the German conservatism. Well, I know why they're conservative. You go in after the fact and just say, well, they're messed up, so that we have to give them our money. It doesn't feel right. Or bailing out companies. It should all be pre-planned. It should be according to rules. So that's what I have in mind. I'm going to have one more idea, and then I'll stop for questions. This has to do with the Occupy Wall Street complaint, the 99. Well, they say we are the 99%. This refers to the fact that the top 1% of earners in the United States saw an increase since 1990 of their real after-tax earnings of almost 60%. Whereas the bottom 99% have seen a decline. So something is going wrong with our income distribution. And I don't see plans to deal with it. So I have a plan, which is very simple. I think that I call it inequality indexation of the tax system, or sometimes I call it inequality insurance, because it's a financial concept. We have a progressive tax system. We should agree now that if some threshold of inequality is reached, we will automatically raise taxes. It won't. Congress decides today that when the 99% is sufficiently disadvantaged relative to the 1%, we stop it because we put increased taxes on the top 1%. And it's automatic. We decide now. Whenever that happens, it goes on automatically. Instructions to the IRS. Change the rates to make it happen. Now, I don't know what the... There was an article by Ian Ayers and Aaron Edlin in the New York Times that described it in this simple term, so I'm oversimplifying a bit, as they did. But the idea is, how much worse do you think we should let inequality get in this country? How about 50% worse or 70% worse? Isn't there some limit to where we will let it go? And if there is, why can't we agree now to have a contingency plan that will automatically stop it then? I think that we're much more likely to succeed in dealing with inequality if we plan for it in advance. That's what finance is all about. It's like insurance. If you're worried about your house burning down, you have to buy insurance on it before it burns down. If after it's ashes, you go to the insurance agent and say, I'd like insurance on this, they won't give it to you anymore. And it's the same thing. If we let inequality get really bad, as I'm not saying it will, I don't know, but it's been trending worse, and it could get worse. No one can gainsay that. If we just let that happen, and it does happen, when that day comes, it's going to be hard to raise taxes on the rich. It's easier to do it now, but that's finance, and that's democratizing finance. So I'll stop with that, and I'll turn it over to you.
That's great stuff. We've got a ton of great questions from the audience, so please feel free to send up more questions. You are listening, to remind you, to listen to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program and our guest, the influential Yale economist and bestselling author Robert Shiller, talking about his new book, Finance and the Good Society, and it is a thought-provoking read. So I'm going to ask a couple questions and take some of the questions I've got in the cards here. I couldn't tell in your book whether Occupy Wall Street inspires you or scares you?
Actually, I think Occupy Wall Street is part of a bigger movement. It's really a continuation of Arab Spring. And it was found in Madrid before Occupy Wall Street. And it's, after that, it's found in Russia with street demonstrations. It's a democratic movement, and it's a discovery that people are rediscovering that protests can bring down governments and can make big changes. So I'm inspired by that part of it, that I think that they're bringing up the dissatisfaction with the inequality that's developing in our society. People have been saying people don't really care. Well, now we know that they do care and that they're wanting to make a change. But I guess my disquiet with 99% is that some of them seem to be saying that my students are doing the wrong thing. I think that my students, I don't speak for all of them, they're all over the world, I guess, but I think that they are doing something just as important if they go into finance and fix it from the inside. And so that's where I differ from... Occupy Wall Street came by Yale recruiters for finance companies and protested as if they were Nazis or something. That's where it's wrong.
Well, I mean, there's this old saying that the problem with socialism is socialism, the problem with capitalism is capitalists.
Right.
But there's this notion in that I wonder, your book lays out these sort of idealistic roles for everyone in the system of finance, from board members to CEOs to bankers. Right. But you mention it, but it seems that the market creates a great place where more base virtues like greed and competition can create a better outcome.
See, this is the thing. This is why we need behavioral finance. People say, why are CEOs compensated so much? Because, you know, in the past, they would do these things out of the goodness of their heart. I mean, to some extent, that's true. You know, you feel a responsibility for the employees. Louis Uchitel had a book in which he writes about executives over the last 50 years and argues that they used to feel more heartfelt concern for their employees, and there's been some decline in that. So I think that our culture maybe could emphasize caring more. I think maybe we're heading that way. But the other side of it is, does that mean that we don't compensate? Should we make a law against paying $50 million to a CEO? And I'm thinking, $50 million is pretty high.
It's been done.
Depends on your perspective. But that's the point. I think that maybe we shouldn't outlaw that. And you see, the thing is, because people are complicated. You know, so Lee Iacocca agreed to work for $1 when he was taking over at Chrysler when it was failing. So is that what he offered to do that? That's great. But can we just count on that? I don't think so. There's a mixture of, and people have motives for anything they do like that.
The heart of a deal, right, whether it's on Wall Street or it's buying a car, the buyer hopes the seller is going to overpay, right?
You get into these situations. Right.
The seller thinks it wants just the opposite outcome, where the two forces that want to take advantage of each other will in the aggregate arrive at better pricing. Those aren't virtuistic goals in a transaction, but it works.
See, there are certain careers. I like my career as a college professor. I don't get into very many moral dilemmas like that. A used car salesman would be a difficult career for me because it.
I think you'd do fine.
Maybe I'd do fine. So that's life. I mean, different careers push you in different directions. So I think the career of a CEO is fundamentally important because they guide an organization. And the reason they're paid, well, there's two reasons why they're paid from so much, a good reason and a bad reason. The good reason is, take some guy who's been running companies. He's 60 years old. He's been great. You know, he has great people skills, and he knows how to turn a company around, supposedly. Maybe he does. And now another company is failing. They've got 10,000 employees. They were a great company and they're failing. And someone says, bring him in. Maybe he can fix it. You know, he's done things. They want him. But then he says, look, I'm tired. You know, my wife wants me to retire. you know, $10 million just doesn't interest him. So they bid him up, and they say, we'll give you $50 million. So he goes back to his wife, and she says, I could get $50 million if I did this. And then let's start a family foundation, maybe, and we can be pillars of the community where...
Where $10 million wouldn't have got that done.
$10 million will only buy you one house in San Francisco.
Right.
Let me get the bad reason. The bad reason is he's got cronies on the board. And they say, we'll fool the shareholders. We'll say that you're a great executive. And remember me sometime. You know, I gave you a favor. It can't be explicit, but someday you'll pay me back. That happens too. That's crony capitalism. So it's not perfect. So Sarbanes-Oxley tried to regulate that by putting outside, requiring that outside members on the compensation committees. I don't know if that fixed it. But so there are issues about executive compensation. And that's what comes to my mind.
Well, and you talk about in the book about the method, and this gets to the questions I want to get to, which is about you in the book talk about preferring stock options, not bonuses, not cash bonuses, as a method to make CEOs better motivated, aligned with the interests of the company. But stock options have been a heart of scandals at Global Crossing, Tenet Healthcare, Quest, HomeStore.com, you name it. And yet you think stock options is a better way to go than bonuses.
There's an argument. Everything is complicated. There's an argument for stock options. Because if you give a CEO a bonus for making a lot of profits this year, the CEO has an incentive to just milk the company for profits. The typical CEO is only going to be there for a few years. So you don't do any long-term planning. You destroy your customer base. You sell things off and play tricks to make profits. That doesn't work as well if you're... compensation is based on the stock price, because then the investors see that and see through it, and the price falls. That's the idea. But again, it's still imperfect, because the CEO can still play tricks by concealing bad news and creating false impression of good news that pushes the stock price up. So I don't know the perfect system. That's why we have to keep experimenting and moving forward. And we also have to think about motivating well-meaning people who don't play tricks like that as much. So that's why I think the benefit corporation might help solve that kind of problem, where you recruit somebody to do a social purpose. I think it changes the whole atmosphere. So it's not something... Sarbanes-Oxley was not as imaginative as we could be in fixing that problem. And I think there will be other ideas and solutions that come forward later.
Question here from the audience about social investing. What role should environmental, social, and corporate governance analysis play in finance and in picking sustainable investment portfolios?
Corporate governance analysis. You mean studying how boards work?
Oh, and environmental and social impacts of the companies, what they're doing, this old notion of social investing.
Yes. It's an old notion, so it's not...
Yes.
I think that we haven't focused on that enough. I think maybe this is a trend that will come back. We went through a period in our history, particularly in the United States, where the greed is good mentality predominated, and it was associated with the efficient markets hypothesis. It was in reaction to abuses that people who claimed to be serving the public good actually filtered money to themselves. There's a famous quote from Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations written in 1776. I can't quote it from memory, but something to the effect that the baker, the butcher, the people that serve our lives are not doing it out of the kindness of their hearts. They were doing it for a profit motive. And I'm trying to quote him approximately. He said, I think that it's those people who serve us better than the self-described philanthropists. In some sense, he's true, because there isn't that much philanthropy. Most of what we get is involved with other people giving. And so I think we overemphasize the Adam Smith view, or that view of Adam Smith. He wasn't so simple. He was complicated, too. And we lived in a period where we thought that we were evangelizing to the world the virtues of self-interested profit-making. And I know that that was the mood on our campuses and in our business offices, that we tightened up. And I'm mentioning Lou Uchitel's book that came out a few years ago. He interviewed executives, and he could see the change, that executives 20, 30 years ago felt more of a mission for their employees than they do now. And so it's a change in our thinking. And I bet the pendulum is swinging back. We were in an extreme period of selfish capitalism, and we are moving out of it.
Well, let me move to a question on everyone's favorite way to give back to the community, taxes. at what level would you advocate a corporate tax rate, and why?
Okay.
Oh, sorry. This is actually a tax everybody loves because it's somebody else paying it.
Corporate tax rate. Okay. There are lots of economists who say it should be zero because it's double taxation. Corporations are owned by people, some of them in low tax brackets, some of them in high tax brackets. For example, the Fireman's Pension Fund will have money in the stock market. So what do we want to do about corporate taxation? I think that there's a plausible argument for setting it to zero, but there are other arguments as well that suggest that maybe it shouldn't be zero. You understand that any organization can get out of the corporate profits tax by redefining themselves as a partnership rather than a corporation. And a lot of groups do that. They tend to be small groups. Groups of lawyers or accountants are typically partnerships rather than corporations. So you can do that. But they suffer liability, that they can be sued, and it can take your home or your car. So some other organizations tend to choose corporate structure. It tends to encourage big organizations. But they also impose costs on society because if they do something wrong, they can't be sued for it. So, for example, TEPCO in Japan ran the Fukushima nuclear power plant. It caused this huge disaster, and now you can't go after the shareholders. The shareholders were profiting from a nuclear power plant that wasn't done right. And then after it's over, they say, sorry, you know, we're not. You can't take it from us. So the Japanese taxpayer has to pay for it. So that's why there is an argument for having a tax on corporate profits.
But should the tax be set on the almost theoretical liability or the cost of having a corporation or having all corporations, or should it be set on some level of need in the community?
I thought you were asking a very technical question until you said need in the community. I don't remember
I'm
that
giving
being
a lot
part
of wiggle room.
I've heard discussions in public finance about optimal corporate taxation. Now, I don't remember this need in the community.
But on some level, that's what the discussion's about, right? When there's anger about the level of corporate taxation, it's about why should we as individuals be taxed so high when the rich corporations are being taxed so low? I wonder if you have a notion of where it should be set.
I'm going to be an academic and say that's a very complicated question.
I'll let you punt. All right, let us move on. More great questions from the audience. The jobs legislation, which you mentioned in its current form, do you think it'll be beneficial? And I want to reference Jesse Eisinger wrote a great column in the New York Times recently, referring to it as the Bucket Shop Employment Act of 2012, that taking away regulations protecting investors maybe isn't so soon after Enron and WorldCom and so on might not be the best thing, and that crowdfunding is a cute name. Bucket Shop is...
Well, you know, Bucket Shop is the name for an institution that was common in the late 19th century and then faded. It disappeared. I think it became outlawed. A bucket shop was a place where you would go and have a glass of whiskey, and there'd be a painting of a nude girl up there, and you'd bet on stock prices. And they got men, and you'd smoke a big cigar, and you'd go in there, and at the end of the day, you lost everything. So we don't want that.
And, you know, and I may have misquoted. You might have also said, referred to it as the Boiler Room Employment Act.
Well, Boiler Room is a little different. Was that what they said? Well,
yes,
Boiler Room is another. The Boiler Room came in when they invented telephones, and they became common. So people would have it. When they got long-distance phone calling in the 1920s, that came in. So a boiler room, you rent the cheapest real estate you can. And that would be the basement of some building where the boiler is, all right? And you'd hire people to make phone calls to investors. And they would pretend they're calling from some glamorous Wall Street office. And they'd call all around the country. And they'd say, I have this hot new stock for you that's going to take off, but I'm going to let you in on the secret. That's a boiler room. And yes, those were abuses. Both the bucket shops and the boiler rooms were abusing less informed people who didn't understand. And so they were both regulated out. And we have to be aware of that. That's why it's a controversial idea. The crowdfunding is a controversial idea because it could bring that back. So that's in the Act. The Act has restrictions on it. It can't be like I mentioned. A man would go in with the family fortune to the bucket shop, and at the end of the day, he had lost the whole thing. It can't happen because it's no more than 2% of your income. And so that is a fundamental protection. So let's not think in oversimplified terms. Bucket shops and boiler rooms were serious problems in an earlier day, but let's not be too afraid of American free enterprise involving the people, because I think that this experiment might really work, and it might be an inspiration. We'll see how it goes, and we can change it if it doesn't work.
I guess there's a notion in this of stomaching some fraud. I mean, in my prior life, prior to hosting Bloomberg West, it was finding fakes and frauds and phony companies, and there are those characters out there who will always use these to create phony stock promotions, run these things up without any results.
Let me say something about self-regulation. We have this organization called FINRA, which is a trade organization of stockbrokers and the like, which imposes ethical standards from within the industry. And they will do continuing education that reaffirms the ethical standards. And what they actually do for stockbrokers in this country, they have them watch little movie clips. And the movie clip will show a stockbroker sitting in his office, and then a client comes in and says, let's do something a little shady, you know. This thing has, I'm going to sign this. It's supposed to be my husband's signature, but I'll sign it, and we'll just not tell anybody. And then in the movie, he acquiesces. And then he's ruined. They show what happens, all of the consequences. So they are trying to remind people that it's a slippery slope.
Although it's supposed to inspire people. Well, no, it's not.
They do show in these movies other people who have the safest route to avoiding getting on the slippery slope, where now you've done something wrong and now you have to cover it up and then it gets worse and worse. This is to be squeaky clean all the time. And that's the inspiration. And you do it out of moral conviction. So you tell her, I will not accept your fake signature because I just can't imagine myself ever doing such a thing.
I'm inspired already. a number of people have sent wrote questions here about Glass-Steagall. And do you think Glass-Steagall should be reinstated? And is that a big issue that needs to be dealt with?
Okay, the Glass-Steagall Act in 34, I think it was, was an act that created Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and it also told banks that they couldn't get involved in what's called investment banking, which is the more risky side of banking. And the reason they put the two together in the same bill is that they thought, well, if the government is going to insure banks, we have to make sure they don't do risky things. And that was the idea of Glass-Steagall. It went along until the late 20th century, and then it was repealed. Then more recently, Paul Volcker got another version called the Volcker Rule, which was brought into the Dodd-Frank Act for much the same reason. It was a little different. These banks were bailed out by the government, and it cost the taxpayers money. So, well, it's basically the same reason. So, but he wanted to define the rule a little differently than Glass-Steagall. But it's the same idea, that banks can't do proprietary trading, risky trading on their own account. And so I think that was... Then you get bogged down in the details, though. And this is where the lobbyists come in. Now, I don't think they're uniformly evil. Maybe some of them are evil. I have a chapter in my book on lobbyists. I think most people are a mixture of good and evil. And the lobbyists, I think, are skilled in finance. And they point out, you're going to shut down all these activities in our bank, but they're integral to what we do when we provide services to the customers. And you can't just shut this down. Well, you can, but you'll destroy our banking system, and we won't be competitive with the international situation. And can you just tinker with this rule a little bit so that we can do this that we've always been doing? And so it gets more and more complicated. Now, is that evil? Is the Volcker rule still functioning? Well, that's a deep, big and deep question. My thought is usually in life, I'm not a good debater because I think that usually in life it's somewhere in the middle, right? I could debate either side of some important point, but then I would be feeling dishonest. Same thing with efficient markets. It's a half-truth. It's not completely wrong. It's not completely right either. So I think the Volcker rule is an extraordinarily difficult thing to discuss in a venue like this. But I think that it's not wrong for the government to get involved with that kind of rulemaking. The details are monstrous.
So a lot of questions about investing and where your investments are and so on. But an intriguing one here, how does investing in the stock market contribute to the real economy outside of the obvious investing in IPOs or secondary markets, sort of creating a market for a new company?
Okay, so this gets back to Karl Marx, who said it was gambling. More recently, a lot of people said that the stock market doesn't fulfill any social function because companies don't raise that much capital by issuing stock anyway. And so what's all this activity for? There's been debate about this in the academic finance literature. Well, it turns out that companies do issue stock to finance their business. But it's often in the form of options to employees or executives. Still, it's still issuing stock. So I don't think that it's a bad thing. But
the notion that it contributes to the economy beyond sort of employment and things, does the existence of a market, I mean, you're talking about futures trading in an index creating the opportunity to risk.
Yeah, there is this sense that there's all this trading back and forth and it's wasted activity. The question is, what do we do about it? I mean, it looks wasteful. A lot of things look... You know, I'll give you a parallel. I mentioned this in my book. Look at all the cashiers at stores. Right? If everyone were completely honest, we could just say, put your money in. You don't need anyone watching you. It seems like there's a tremendous waste in Sam Bowles, who's a left-wing economist, did an estimate of the amount of guards.
Well, you talk about that.
Yeah, it was a huge, I forget the exact number, it was a huge percent. Lots of things happened that seemed wasteful.
Yeah, I think
and idealists
like
think that
14% of the U.S. economy are people guarding something.
Yes, right, and that seems wasteful. But then the question is, everything is imperfect, and this system that we have, we don't really understand why it works as well as it does, given the imperfections of people. And so you look at certain things that seem wrong, that seem wasteful, but they're kind of consequences of a system that has other purposes. There is this thing about the Tobin tax. My colleague at Yale proposed that we put a tax on transactions to discourage all this trading back and forth.
And there's a big push about this, in particular, high-frequency trading.
And high-frequency or millisecond trading. Now you have traders that will program a computer to trade within a thousandth of a second. They can respond faster than anybody else to the market situation. And what they sometimes do is they'll place a buy order for 1 millisecond. Okay. It goes up, bang! Everything's electronic now. 1 millisecond,
so
it's out there.
Is that bad?
Now the question is that bad? Now, I don't necessarily know the answer to everything. You're asking me, so I'll try to give my answer.
I'm hoping someone knows.
I think that it's relatively harmless. And I've talked to people who do millisecond trading, and they say, I don't see what the big issue is. I'm doing the same basic business that I used to do. It's just like an engineer who used to have a slide rule to do calculations, and now he has a computer, and he does millisecond or microsecond calculations. Everything is sped up, and we kind of have to live with that. The world is faster, and if you don't get in line first, that means in the first millisecond, your customer might lose out. But so we always get in line first. But is it essential? And the idea is, no, we're doing the same business we've always done. And if you look at the Forbes 400 list of richest people, I don't think any one of them is a millisecond trader. So I don't think that it's as dangerous as it may seem.
They might be millisecond billionaires, though.
It could happen. Anything can change. You know, I don't know what risks the millisecond trading might someday have, but I don't see it as a central issue now.
Do you see a role, an expanded role for the government to sort of pick favored borrowers because of the social good, so that you have borrowers who are, you know, obviously the government has given breaks to homeowners, right, tax breaks, so that to inspire people to buy more homes.
Yeah.
But should that go beyond, there are benefits to municipal lending, right, to building bridges and tunnels and roads and so on. But do you, as part of your notion in the book, that the government could get involved to inspire these benefit corporations or public works and lending for drug treatment clinics or churches,
right,
or community centers or whatever?
Well, I think that what you're describing was called by Henry Clay the American system. Do you know that?
Yeah.
Henry Clay was a great U.S. senator, and he coined the term the American system. So what do you imagine that is? Well, partly it's something that I don't particularly like, high tariffs. But forget that part of the American system. The other part of the American system was government involvement in promoting enterprise. The governments got involved in building canals, in improving harbors. This country was not laissez-faire. I mean, it had a laissez-faire element to it, but it did. The really laissez-faire economics came later. Notably in the mid to late 20th century. So I don't think that there's... I think that it does pay to have a government that thinks of... So Governor Clinton in New York advocated for years supporting the Erie Canal. And it was a private investment, but it had the support of the government. A wonderful thing that happened. The government... And then with the railroads, the government supported the railroads. I don't think that we want to leave things entirely to laissez-faire market forces.
So we reach a point.
We have to be careful, too, because you can go too far. This is my philosophy as a teacher. Most things are half-truths, and we don't have clear and solid laws in economics that approach those of physics. Ooh. There's going to be some role for the government. But then once the government has a role, there's a risk that they'll be bribed or bought out and go too far. Well, it's a complicated world. But I actually have faith that this country is moving forward, and so is the whole world, moving forward. It's less corrupt than it used to be. We have a lot of laws and regulations that are making it harder to do these evil things. And it looks complicated, and it's annoying. But it's civilization.
Well, let me ask. We just got time for just one quick question here. Less than 2 minutes left here. But you write in the book that finance is not about making money.
Right.
So in a minute, what is it?
All right. Well, I have my own etymology of the word. I shouldn't have my own etymology.
You may.
It's sort of an expansive etymology. Look up finance in the dictionary. And it says, it comes from Old French, but before that it comes from the Latin word finis, F-I-N-I-S, which means end. And different dictionaries say different things, but the basic idea is that it comes somehow from when you completed a financial deal, they would write finis at the end in Latin, meaning deal done. And so somehow that became finance. But I was noting that the word finis in ancient Latin, classical Latin, means end. And I was wondering, in English, the word end has two meanings. It means the final step, but it also means purpose, right? What are your ends? What are your goals? And I found in an old Latin, classical Latin dictionary, that it had exactly that double meaning in ancient times. So finis meant goal, purpose. And so I think that what I'm thinking is that finance, my definition of finance is it's about financing activities, making things happen. That means allowing people to achieve their goals. If you democratize finance, different people have different goals. Some of them are religious groups. Some of them are hospitals. Some people want to see scientific progress. Different people have different goals. We want to make it possible to achieve those goals. So another example I mentioned in my book, you have a child who's handicapped, and the child is going to live longer than you. You want to protect this child. Now, what are you going to do? The child is unable of taking care of himself or herself. So you want to create a trust for the child. You can go to a trust company and say, I want you to manage this account for my child after I'm gone. And they do that. That's part of modern finance. But that's just one example of the kind of goals that people have. The problem is that most of our important goals in life take that form. I can't do it myself. I need other people to support this goal. And I want it to continue through time. It's not a goal for the next year. It's a goal for 100 years or whatever. And so that's how I define. So finance is about stewardship, protection of goals, and it's about getting people to work together effectively to achievement of goals. Now, that is not a definition of finance you'll find in any textbook. It's my expansive definition.
Except for your terrific book. And I told you the book was inspiring. See? We're out of time. Thanks, Robert Shiller, economist and bestselling author of Finance and the Good Society. Thanks to our audience here and on the radio and television and the Internet. I'm Corey Johnson. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.